Last week we had a very helpful introduction to the book of Exodus, and we thought particularly about God's people under oppression in Egypt. The scene was set for the Exodus story to begin. Today we come to a man, Moses, one of the greatest men of the Bible. The massive 16-volume Encyclopedia Judaica begins its entry about him like this. The Bible enshrines a galaxy of great men and women, each of whom made a distinctive contribution to Jewish history and culture. Moses towers above them all. He is incomparable. He's not only a national leader, it's he who fashioned the nation of Israel, transforming a horde of slaves into a kingdom of priests. F.F. Bruce has written this: he was the all-round man of God, leader, judge, guide, legislator, intercessor, Yahweh's incomparable prophet and spokesman, whom he knew face to face and with whom he spoke mouth to mouth. In short, he's a spiritual giant, mentioned more than any other biblical figure in the New Testament, supremely significant, as you'll know, because as Israel's lawgiver and liberator, his ministry parallels and prefigures that of Jesus himself. In a sense, the Old Testament revolves around Moses in the same way as the New Testament revolves around Jesus Christ. But as we'll see in this, and I hope the next few sermons, he is a man with faults as well as strengths, weaknesses as well as virtues. And that helps us to identify with him straight away. Chapter 2 is a skillfully narrated sketch of his early life. There can hardly be anyone here who hasn't at some time heard something or other about Moses and the bulrushes, even if it's only been through the efforts of Cecil B. DeMille. Now, as a general rule, the Old Testament only introduces facts when they're relevant to the story. So the details are therefore important, and it's right that we look briefly at them. I'd like to do that, if I may, under my first heading. I've called that God's Man. But even more significant than the facts and the details is the underlying theme of the chapter. Indeed, it's a theme of the whole book, gradually spelt out, not appearing expressly until right at the end of chapter 2, but there by implication before that, and that's this: the sovereign providence of God. What I'll call simply God's plan. Behind, you see, what happens to God's man, Moses, is at every stage, as I hope we'll see, God's plan, his sovereign providential will. The message that comes across loud and clear is that God is the unseen controller of all history and all circumstances. Let's begin then with God's man. Four pictures tell the story in this chapter. The first comes in verses 1 to 8. I've called it the drama of preservation. We know the background. Pharaoh's labor camps had failed to break the Hebrew spirit, had failed to minimize their growth in numbers, and so the next plan, something that was to be repeated more than once in Jewish history, is genocide. The end of chapter 1 records the decree, verse 22. Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." And then straight away, in chapter 2, verse 1, we're introduced to Moses' parents. The names come later. Father is Amram, mother Joshebed. The only clue we're given at this stage is that they're from the house of Levi. Not Joseph, not Judah, as we might have expected. That's a bit of a surprise for a start, because a couple of chapters back in Genesis 49, we read of old Jacob cursing Levi and his brother Simeon for their violence. Could it really be that God's now going to bring his deliverer from such a shaky background? Think how Moses' parents, any pregnant Hebrew parents, must have felt living under that decree. You can almost feel them longing for another daughter. but it's not to be. It's a son. Now, everybody always thinks their new baby's absolutely marvelous, no matter what it looks like. But it seems that even by an objective standard, for once, the parents are right, and Moses is something special. Verse 2, his mother sees he is a goodly child. Or, as Stephen says in his sermon on Moses in Acts 7:20, Moses was beautiful in the sight of God. Now, God, in some simple but very clear way, spoke to Moses' parents through that little face. And the message they heard, loud and clear, was, "Don't worry about Pharaoh. Trust me implicitly with this baby, and I'll not let him come to grief. Trust me in the way this little one will trust you." Now, in case you think I'm making this up, glance across to page 210 of the New Testament section, to Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23. You see, Exodus 2 is silent about motivation. And as Matthew Henry says, the best exposition we have of Exodus chapter 2 is from an inspired pen in Hebrews chapter 11. Look at verse 23. There's the answer. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hid for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. You see, Moses' parents believed in the way they did because of their faith. They weren't afraid. Faith is a persuasion, and persuasion cancels fear. They'd every reason to be afraid for their own lives and for this child, but they weren't. Why? Because God was at work in this child, and they were convinced of it. They were prepared to trust him for the future. Keep a finger, if you would, in Hebrews chapter 11, because we may need to go back there in a moment. At any rate, back to Exodus 2, they hold on, verse 3, as long as they can, but soon the bawling of young Moses would have wakened the dead, not to mention Pharaoh's security services. So suddenly and dramatically, they have to take that step which every believing parent has to take at some stage or other, and that's to turn their child completely over to God. For most of us, happily, the circumstances are somewhat less dramatic. Here they look downright hazardous. Verse 3, set adrift in the Nile shallows, in, of all things, a papyrus basket, which was neither crocodile, sword, nor drown-proof. God sometimes seems to have a strange way of working. But you know the outcome, the drama of verses 5 and 6. Miriam's heart must have missed a beat as she saw Pharaoh's daughter and her bathing party come on her little brother. But amazingly, verse 6, Pharaoh's daughter takes pity on him. And verse 7, Miriam is right there to recommend the ideal Hebrew foster mother. Surprise, surprise, his very own mother. What a remarkable series of coincidences. Or were they? God sometimes seems to have a strange way of working. The second picture is in verses 9 and 10. I've called it the quality of education. Try to imagine his mother's joy at having him back again. Verse 9, openly, officially, and with a salary thrown in. Some of you know Dick Lucas's joke that going into the ministry is like being Moses' mother, doing the thing nearest to your heart and being paid for it. Imagine how she must have loved him, thanked God for him, said to God, "Why did I doubt you for a moment?" Entrusted him to God every day, prayed for him. And what an effect on his development those prayers had. The text says simply, verse 10, the child grew. But can't you feel the weight of godly parents' prayer and nurture behind that, molding him in the long term? Those of us who are parents of young children have a heavy responsibility for the charges that God has given us. But that's only half the story. The time comes, verse 10, when inevitably he's brought to Pharaoh's daughter. and becomes her son. She gives him his name, and from a simple and godly Hebrew home, he's plunged into the affluence and sophistication of court life. He has the best of everything that money can buy, and a thoroughgoing pagan education. Stephen again supplies the detail in Acts 7:22. He was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in his words and deeds. Whatever else Moses was learning, you can be sure that it wasn't about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. On the contrary, in every way, this young man was developing a thoroughly Egyptian worldview. He was thoroughly immersing himself in Egyptian culture. Not exactly the sort of training one would expect for a future leader of the children of Israel. God sometimes seems to have a very strange way of working. The third picture is in verses 11 to 15. I've called it the cost of identification. The great crisis of adolescence is supposed to be connected to discovering who we are. Now, according to Stephen in Acts 7:23, Moses is 40 when he has his crisis. Indeed, there's a real sense here in which for him life begins at 40. Verse 11, he goes out to his people and looks on their burdens. Just when we might have expected Moses to be settling down to the security of middle age, never mind adolescence, just when his poor parents were probably giving up on him ever making any sort of spiritual mark, and wondering why on earth their prayers hadn't been answered, God prompts him to sever his ties with the palace. I say God, because glancing back again to Hebrews 11:24 and 25, they make it clear that again his identification with God's people is a response of faith. How had God spoken to him during those years? Perhaps it was through the physical sign of his circumcision, which he saw every time he took off his clothes. Perhaps it was through a burning sense of injustice as he looked out of the window of the palace and saw the plight of those Hebrew slaves. However it was, the message was clear. Remember who you are. Don't let Egypt squeeze you into its mold. And like his parents before him, in response to God's prompting, he acts decisively in throwing in his lot with the Hebrews. And in doing so, he becomes, as the Encyclopedia Judaica describes it, the prototype of the unassimilable Jew. But straight away, verse 12, there's a problem. He falls for the temptation to a shortcut. And, as a self-appointed freedom fighter, he violently kills the Egyptian oppressor. In a way, it's so sad. He's the right man, on the right mission, deliverance, but going about it completely the wrong way. You see, he'd run ahead of God. God's plan for deliverance was to have a very different shape. Having said that, it took real courage to leave those palace relationships of so many years' standing. It probably took some guts to kill the Egyptian. And having stepped out in faith in a way that he was convinced was so clear, you can imagine him thinking, now I'll wait for God to reward what I've done. Now I'll wait for God to give me some confirmation. This is bound to win me the respect and praise and support of my people. But, ironically, exactly the opposite happens. And, verse 14, they object to his interference. They resent his authority, and they reject his deliverance. Stephen says again in Acts 7:25, he supposed that his brethren understood that God was giving them deliverance by his hand, but they did not understand. No, you see, Moses had to learn the very important lesson, which was to stand him in good stead, that some of the most painful persecution and most frustrating misunderstanding actually comes from within the family of God itself. So often, when we're waiting to be cheered, all that comes is criticism. God sometimes seems to have a strange way of working. The fourth and final picture is in verses 15b to 22. I've called it the time for maturing. As Martin Lloyd-Jones once said, the worst thing that can happen to a man is to have success before he's ready. And Moses here just wasn't ready. Neither, for that matter, were the children of Israel. Preparation was needed on both sides. So, verse 15b, Moses, the great deliverer, fled from Pharaoh, making his first exodus to the desert, not as a commander, but as a criminal, a man on the run. Having got his BA in Egypt, he's to take his MA in the desert, where the syllabus looks desperately ordinary and down to earth. Look at it briefly. Verse 17, sheep. Verse 21, marriage. Verse 22a, children. Verse 22b, putting in time. And behind these everyday things, learning maturity and godly patience. I wonder how often Moses said to himself, I'm in a rut. Is this what I'm really cut out for? What on earth is God keeping me here for when I could be doing so much for him in Egypt? This goes on for 40 years. Has God forgotten the needs of his people? Has he no sense of urgency? What's he doing? You can almost hear Moses running those questions through his mind. But it's not time yet. God sometimes seems to have a strange way of working. Or does he? The final section from verses 23 to 25, I've called God's plan. We take a look behind the scenes. Had God forgotten Israel? All the outward evidence suggested that he had. The people groaned. But four key verbs in these verses make the contrary clear beyond all shadow of doubt. Look at them. Verse 24. God heard their groaning. God remembered his covenant. Verse 25. God saw the people of Israel. God knew their condition. Four important affirmations about a sovereign God who's in control and whose timing is perfect. And as the writer says, implies, if you doubt it, look back at the early life of Moses. Why, you see, is he born into a generation being faced with extinction? How do his parents manage to conceal him for 3 months? How does he manage to survive the river? Why is he discovered by Pharaoh's daughter herself? Why is she sympathetic? How is it that he manages to be looked after by his own mother? Why is he delivered and rehabilitated after his murder of the Egyptian? Why does Israel have to wait? The answer is the sovereign providence of God. You see, who was in control of the political, social, and physical forces at work in this story? Pharaoh? No. Satan? No. God himself. Let me try to apply this practically. Moses, someone objects, was a special case. God had a special plan for him, and if you like, a number of divine strings were pulled to see him through. It's just not like that for me. Indeed, most of us are prepared to acknowledge God acting in the great moments of history. But when we come to our personal histories, we're less confident. Can God really be, as Schaeffer says, acting into my personal history in a loving way? Can he really have a plan for me? Are the minute details of my life really ordered by the providence of God? It's a thought so big we can hardly grasp it, but the doctrine which A.W. Pink, in his excellent book, The Sovereignty of God, refers to as the warp and woof of Scripture. and the foundation of Christian theology says it's true, the sovereignty of God. You see, at its simplest, God is either in control or he's controlled. He either rules or is ruled. He's either accomplishing his will or being thwarted by his creatures. There are no middle courses. So, bring our four affirmations into the present tense and ask yourself if you believe them. God hears. God remembers. God sees. God knows. How are we to react? No generation has lived and breathed the doctrine of the providence of God like the Puritans. But their interest in the doctrine of providence was always thoroughly practical. In 1700, Thomas Sharp wrote a book with the marvelous title, Divine Comforts, Antidoting Inward Perplexities of Mind. And one of the deepest of those comforts was a grasp of the sovereign providence of God. Now, if you're anything like me, you'll constantly be seeking antidotes for inward perplexities. Certainly the Israelites in Egypt and Moses in the desert needed them. Let me suggest that laying hold of the providence of God is an antidote to three spiritual problems that afflict us all. Let me suggest, first of all, that it cures a sense of failure. The remarkable fact is that God, in his plan, actually uses our sins and mistakes and failures to help us grow in grace. The Bible, you see, is full of men of God making mistakes and God dealing with them. Abraham can't wait for God. He plays the amateur providence and Ishmael is born. He has to wait 13 years before God speaks to him again. Moses tries to save his people by acts of self-assertion, throwing his weight around, and he finds himself sent to the desert for 40 years to cool off. We could go on, David, Jonah. But in each case, the human mistake and the immediate divine displeasure are not the end. God brings good out of all these situations. There are those, it's said that those who never make mistakes never make anything. And certainly these men made mistakes. But through them, God taught them to know his grace in a way that wouldn't have happened otherwise. So whether it's a personal failure, a failure in service or commitment, remember that God's purpose cannot be thwarted. If your problem is a sense of failure, go back to God. He has a plan for your life that's bigger than the biggest mistake you've ever made. His restoring grace is waiting for you. He knows and accepts you. Secondly, it's a cure for complaining. This was Israel's problem, verse 23. And so often it's ours. Why, we ask. Why have I no money? Why am I persecuted? Why is my job so difficult? Why am I stuck in the house with all this ironing? Why have we no children? Why am I single? Why that cot death? Why that car crash? Why is my child handicapped? Why did he die so young? Why can't I seem to get through to God? Why doesn't he hear? And God answers in the face of our anger and frustration, I know. I hear. I see every detail. Oh, there are no easy answers to these deeply perplexing questions, and I'm not trying to suggest that there are. As John Flavel says, there are hard texts in the works as well as the Word of God. But when all's said and done, we will never know peace till we bow in faith before the sovereignty of God. As Samuel Rutherford says in his letters, infinite sovereignty may lay silence upon all hearts. Some of us are like children, you see, blowing a thistle or pulling the petals from a plant in our relationship with God. He loves me. He loves me not. He loves me. He loves me not. But it's just not like that, you see. God's character is unchanging. and his purposes for us are unchanging. And like his character, they're good. Oh, it didn't seem like that to Israel at the time. Far from it. As far as they were concerned, God seemed to be a powerless irrelevance. But we know that in reality, before they'd even asked, he had begun to provide for their glorious deliverance. Oh, if only they'd been prepared to wait, to learn, in Thomas Manton's phrase, to trust in a withdrawing God, a God who seemed to be silent, but who was in fact preparing, working, saving, caring. Then they would have known peace. Finally and briefly, it's a cure for fear. Which one of us, at times, isn't afraid of the future? Like the Israelites, we cry, what's to become of us? What's God doing with us? Where are we going? We have financial fears. How will I manage? We have family fears. How will I educate my children? How will they turn out? We have personal fears. How will I cope with old age? We've got political fears. What is going to happen in the world politically? We all have fears of the unknown. Sometimes the pressures almost push us under. But we forget who we are, the children of God, in a covenant relationship with him. And God doesn't forget that. Quite the opposite, verse 24, he remembers his covenant. And the God of the covenant has promised, Romans 8:28, that in everything he works for good with those who love him and who are called according to his purpose. Easy to say, harder to believe, but above all, true. Jim Packer argues the point forcefully in Knowing God. One day, he says, we shall see that nothing, literally nothing, which could have increased our eternal happiness has been denied us. And nothing, literally nothing, that could have reduced that happiness has been left with us. What higher assurance, he asks, do we want than that? There'll be many, many times when we need to fall back on this, when God seems to have abandoned us, when he's silent. Israel did. The Exodus became a real touchstone for their faith. We all need, in John Flavel's phrase, to keep the faith of adherence when we've lost the faith of evidence. Remembering that even when we're not thinking about God, he's still thinking about us. The things that concern us concern him too. You see, if God loved you enough to bring you to himself, he loves you enough to see it through. I must end. We've seen something of God's man, the way he was molded. Behind that, we've seen God's plan. And when in that plan we see the sovereignty of God, we gaze on the sovereign himself. The God who sees, who knows, who hears, who remembers. The God who's shaping everything in time and space, ultimately to promote his glory. A glory that we are to share with him. What a prospect. Like Moses in Exodus 15:11, our only response can be one of wonder and adoration. Who is like you, Lord, majestic in holiness, worthy of awe and praise?